Hi, this is Jason Mudd with Axie Public Relations. And on this episode of On Top of PR, we are joined by Peter Shankman, the founder of Haro and a serial entrepreneur, author, global keynote speaker, and just an all-around great guy and somebody who has given back significantly to the PR profession and the business world. I'm thrilled to have Peter on the show, and I know you will enjoy listening in on this episode.
Welcome to On Top of PR with Jason Mudd, presented by ReviewMaxer.
Welcome to the next episode of On Top of PR. I'm your host, Jason Mudd, and today I'm joined by the Peter Shankman. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jason. Good to have you. Good to be here.
We're glad you're here, too. So, Peter, we first connected years ago when you were launching and enjoying a lot of success from Haro, Help a Reporter Out. That was and remains a great tool for PR practitioners and those who are not in the PR space to connect with journalists who are seeking sources. Prior to that, you had success running an agency. Peter, that agency was called Geek Factory. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. And around that time, I guess you started authoring some books, and I picked up what I think was your first book. Can We Do That? Is that the right title of it?
That is correct, yeah.
Yeah. And that was a great read. I really enjoyed getting my hands on that and passing it around the office and sharing that with others. So thank you for agreeing to be on the show. And I just would love to share kind of some of your stories of best practices in public relations, how you have found success. And also ultimately, the many ways that you are giving back and how our audience might be able to connect with you and follow you on the various platforms that you are very active in, Peter.
Sure. I mean, I can tell you, I still do a lot, and we're living in the dystopian end of days right now, but it's interesting times, but I'm still very active. I'm still a corporate keynote speaker. I've been doing a lot. I've moved entirely virtual. What used to take 4 days to get to Asia, give a speech, come back from Asia, now it takes 45 minutes. So it's certainly a new world. But there's a need more than ever for solid communication. There's a need for best practices in all things, from hiring to communication to customer experience, and I find that companies are reaching out to me now more than ever. Actually, it's strange. I'm busier than I've ever been. Yet when you take travel out of the equation, I still have a lot of downtime. So it's a nice mix, I guess.
It's I find it refreshing. I don't travel nearly as much as you do, but it is nice. I think you and I both recently flew sometime in June-ish, and it had been a while. And I thought that was interesting, well, especially with less crowds at the airport, if that makes sense.
It's been nice to take a break. I, however, miss it terribly. All of my writing, all of my books, everything I do is done on planes. And to not be flying is very difficult. And, add that to being sort of trapped in New York City, where you try to avoid going out as much as possible in the world we're currently in. So it's been difficult, I won't lie.
It's probably difficult to live in the city that never sleeps and never go out.
Well, they say that in New York City, you pay a ridiculously high mortgage for what's outside your apartment. Mm-hmm. You don't pay for what's inside. You pay for what's outside. Unfortunately, we're not allowed to use anything that's outside. So that definitely makes it difficult. No question about
it. Sure. Absolutely. Well, Peter, you opened the door, so I'm gonna walk right in. And that would be, first of all, you have a very helpful newsletter that you send out, and it's full of great content and challenging your audience and making the readers not only learn, but also rethink many of their assumptions. And so I really enjoy getting that from you. How does somebody go about getting on that email?
Yeah, head over to shankman.com and there'll be a nice little pop-up. Otherwise, you can go to shankman.com/emails. Same thing. But yeah, my newsletter is about 60,000 strong, I believe. And, you have to understand having an audience is a privilege, not a right. And so when I am fortunate enough to get someone to join me, it is imperative that I give them content that they're expecting, that they want, that helps them, that is useful. I think that, way too many people look at having a newsletter along the lines of oh, well, I got these people listening to me. I can say whatever I want. And it doesn't really work like that.
Right.
I've spent, especially running Harrow. I mean, when I was running Harrow, I was sending out, close to a million emails a day. Beat a 79% open rate.
Right.
On every single email. Right. Yeah, and so,
incredible.
You know, the key is give your audience content they want that helps them, and they'll do it for you.
Right. Yeah. So I know your passion is related to one of your most recent books and your own podcast. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So I have massive ADHD. I was diagnosed as an adult. When I was a kid in New York growing up, it was called sit down, you're disrupting the class disease. And so I realized that there had to be something different about my brain, but that was not only, you know, that would get me into trouble my whole life, it was also a key to my success. And over time, I realized that what came to be called ADHD, I realized I couldn't be the only one. There had to be other people who were dealing with the same thing. And so a little informal research led me to find out that not only were there a lot of people with ADHD, but a surprisingly high number of them were successful entrepreneurs. And so that led to a podcast called Faster Than Normal, and then a book of the same name, a best-selling book of the same name. We've had on the podcast, we've had everyone from Seth Godin to Tony Robbins, Keith Krotz of DocuSign, Dave Neilman of JetBlue, who else? The band Shinedown. We've had PhDs, we've had authors, we've had politicians, professional sports players, all of whom share this commonality of having a neurodiverse brain. And some of the research I've done has led to the fact that, to discover that in the next 10 years, close to 20 to 25% of the workforce is going to be neurodiverse. That's ADD, ADHD, autism spectrum, executive function, you name it. And so dyslexia falls under that. And so if you are an employer, you have to start thinking about how to hire and retain these brilliant minds. Mm-hmm. If you are a business, you have to start thinking about not only how to hire and retain, but how to sell to an audience that is neurodiverse as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked with a major fast food chain last year to help redesign their menu, because you walked in and to their restaurant and you looked up and there was 130 items on the menu, you know, with flashing lights and you know, digital commercials, and you know, that's enough for me to blow my brains out. And so I'm like, no, this can't be. If you walk into an In-N-Out burger, you know, it's hamburger, cheeseburger, fries, shake. That's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And so simplicity in this case can rule. So I do a lot with that, teaching companies how to understand and address neurodiversity. I've worked with companies big and small, Adobe. I've worked with airlines, things like that. And so the key really is, you know, sort of understanding both your audience from a hiring perspective as well as from a selling perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. So what would be some advice you might give to, say, corporate marketing departments where maybe the leader or one of the supervisors in the department is struggling because they sense they have an employee that they just, you know, are struggling to manage, supervise, direct, and guide. Is autonomy a good solution to give that person?
Autonomy is a good solution when it's layered on deadlines. Okay. So in other words, if you tell me that I have a project due on Thursday at 3 p.m., you're going to get it. You're going to get it by Thursday at 3 p.m., if not earlier. Mm-hmm. But if you tell me, hey, get me this as soon as you can, you're never going to get it. Because it'll become the most important thing until the next project I'm given. And then that becomes the most important thing, and so on and so on. So one of the keys to managing is deadlines, is clear cut deadlines that are right in front of the person. You know, my assistant, I don't have right access to my calendar. She took that away from me over 10 years ago.
Okay.
Because, you know, I would, I think the breaking point for her was I scheduled two dinners on the same night on separate continents. And, you know, she's just like, yeah, we're done here. And so, you know, to save her sanity and me, you know, she controls my calendar now. And so if I want to do something, I email her. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, you focus, when people with ADHD, people who are neurodiverse, they focus on what they're good at.
Mm-hmm.
and they outsource as much as possible what they're bad at.
Yeah. Right.
So if, you know, there's a reason I don't do my own lawyering. There's a reason I don't cut my own hair. There, you know, things that, well, ironically, I do cut my own hair now, but you know, I do the things that I'm good at, and I pay other people to do the things that I'm not. And that sort of keeps my life in a symbiotic balance.
Yeah. I love it. Allegedly, that's what Bill Gates says, is do what you do best and outsource the rest.
No question about it. You have to. I mean, if you know, I know, especially when I consider how much my time is worth, right? How much do I charge for a 1 hour keynote? It's a lot of money. Yep. Right. So if I'm going to waste an hour, do I waste an hour cleaning my own apartment, or do I hire someone to do it so I can do other things? And by the way, they're going to do it much better than I am anyway.
That's absolutely right. I agree. So going back to what you said about deadlines, I think just important is communication, right? If we're communicating well, we've shared a deadline, we've shared a priority, we've set some expectations. And I think that's where we as leaders can get lazy, because we think everybody can read our mind. And, you know, I've definitely learned from that. One of our previous guests, a great episode, was Dolly Penland, and she does personality assessments and coaches how to, you know, manage to personality types and things like that. And one of the best things she taught me, Peter, was I had this employee who just thought that everything was kind of laissez-faire. And so, you know, we would say, and you know the drill, we would pitch media, we would send out a news release, and she'd hear nothing. And she'd go, well, when they're ready, they'll contact us and tell us they're ready to cover it. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. The event is still Friday, regardless of what happens, right? And so Dolly taught me that what we have to do is tell her, this is what completion and success look like, not just check a box, I sent something. Completion and success looks like pickup of, you know, from this outlet or that outlet or this industry trade interviews, et cetera. And that was a great lesson for me.
Well, that's always really been the key. You know, if you define the terms, right? If you define the terms in terms of what you should be doing, what you should expect, you know, I'm never going to fire anyone for making a mistake. Right. But I'll fire you if you don't ask.
Right.
Ask me as many times as you need to get it perfect. Once you have it perfect, I expect it to be perfect every single time.
Yeah.
Right. So it's you know, I'll never get angry at someone because they didn't know the answer. But don't tell me that you'll find the answer and then don't do it. You know, find the answer. Know what we're talking about. Go from there.
Yeah. Cool. So, Peter, with all the years that you have been in the public relations field, you have certainly shared some great tips. I've been on some teleseminars and webinars you've done with news reporters. What do you see that, you know, either corporate marketers or PR people, what are common mistakes you see them making when they're approaching the news media?
I think the first thing you have to realize is the story is not about you. Mm-hmm. Way too many people think the story is about them. And, you know, it's never about you. It's always about making the reporter's life easier. Any story you do has to be up making a reporter's life easier. If you can do that, you're going to get placed whatever you want to get placed. Also understand that 99% of what you believe to be news is may very well be you news, but not to you. Or, I'm sorry, may well be news to you and no one else. Right.
Right.
And so the key really is, you know, what can you create that people think is worthwhile, not just to you, right? So for me, I think the best rule I ever learned was make your story about an industry. Don't make your story about one company or one thing in particular. Make it as much as possible about an industry.
Okay.
And if you can do that, then you have the ability to get the reporter interested, because then it becomes a bigger story, right? It's not something boring. It's nothing, whatever. It's something that they want to use, that they can craft into a bigger pitch. And I found the best way to do that really is to involve the people, involve your competitors, right? Reach out to your competitors and, you know, ask them, hey, is this a trend? And if so, you know, offer it to them. And you know, the reporter, if you're the one who brought the story to them, they'll honor you with the first one, right? You don't necessarily need to worry about getting scooped in there, but you know, find a trend, get two or three confirmations out of two or three different companies that you work with that work in your industry, and you know, pitch that.
One of my favorite lines is, "When's the last time you went to a movie?" To see a movie that was about a legal entity or a building, right? It's the people that are doing the work, people that are fit, overcoming the adversity. Typically somebody has a problem and, you know, great storytelling, right? So yeah, it's like, just like, you
know, yeah, a lot of it is just being brilliant at the basics, you know?
I like that.
And it's so funny because being brilliant at the basics is so I don't need you to be awesome, yeah, right? I don't need you to be amazing. I don't need you to walk on water. I need you to suck slightly less than everyone else.
Right.
And the bar is so unbelievably low right now.
Yep.
That's not really that hard. You know, mm-hmm. I look at the my favorite joke. The two guys are out in the middle of the woods in a trail run, and they see a bear, and they freak out, and the bear sees them and he raises his hands. The first one says, "Oh my God, we're gonna die." And the second one leans down and tightens up his running shoes. The first one says, "You can't outrun a bear." It's like, "I just need to outrun you."
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
A good so one. That's really all it comes down to. Just need to outrun you.
Yeah. That's very good. Very good. Peter, you've done a good job of building relationships with the media. You know, I know you get called on for interviews with some frequency. I remember reading and some of the, you know, either one of your books or many of the content that you've prepared over the years. Tell our audience about how you kind of made a name for yourself just by simply reaching out to media and offering to be helpful.
Well, I mean, that's how Harrow started. The concept of talking to reporters when I had nothing to sell them, but offering something to them, seeing how I could help them create, you know, what are you working on? I know people. I had tons and tons and tons of resources and connections. I know so many people. How can I help turn those people into sources that you might need? And that led to Help a Reporter Out, because reporters would start calling me and they'd be, hey, I'm doing a story on whatever. I heard you know people, you know, and it would take me like 9 hours to find someone, but I'd get it. Yeah. I'm like, it's a better way to do this. And that led to the creation of Help a Reporter Out.
Yeah, absolutely. And we get those calls at our agency all the time. And it's one of those things you want to pay it forward, but at the same time, how many hours or, you know, an hour or so do you want to spend? And then of course you get somebody on the phone and they're like, okay, but what's this going to cost me? Or why do I need to do this? And it's like, that's 101 stuff. So you have to spend some time doing that as well. At least that's been our experience. So
no question about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, let's see. You mentioned earlier, first of all, what you mentioned there was, you know, a lot of people. And I think that goes back to kind of, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, when you realize you were quote unquote different than everybody else, right? I mean, you've got a ton of contacts. You get more stuff done than everybody else does. And we were talking about earlier about how some people might find that difficult to manage. But I think if you embrace that, whether it's you individually or whether it's somebody on your team, and you leverage those capabilities and you make life easy for them to succeed, then you've really got a win-win. So kind of how do you stay motivated and productive at such a high level, Peter?
I think for me, one of the things is understanding how my brain works and understanding what I need to function. So for me, it's a lot about exercise. I spend, I wake up usually around 3:45 to 4 a.m. and I am on my Peloton bike or on my treadmill or out for a run or lifting or whatever, something pretty much 6 days a week if I can. Mm-hmm. The whole reason I haven't gained any weight during lockdown is because I exercise every day. I haven't lost any weight because I'm working 3 inches from my fridge, but I haven't gained any weight. So I consider that a win. You know, but it's not so much for the weight. I do it because the dopamine release that I get from exercise mm-hmm. kicks me into gear for the entire day. If I don't exercise, I don't have that good of a day. And I've had my daughter, 7 years old, but, you know, mentioned, "Daddy, were you on the bike today?" "No." "Yeah, no, you don't look happy." You know? So the key really is to understand how your brain works and give yourself the tools to handle the setbacks that you'll have, right? Nothing's going to be perfect. You're not going to win every single time. But how you deal with that rejection, what you learn from it, can be a great source for the next time. And I've learned that over time. You know, you know, for every keynote I get, I'm sure there's a bigger one that I wanted to get, you know, or whatever the case may be. And what can I learn to improve that? And as long as I learn from something, I don't really consider it a loss, right? Yeah. If I can learn from something, I don't consider it a loss.
We learn more from failure than we do success.
Oh, no question about it. No question about it.
Yeah. In fact, you're reminding me of a video that you shot a year or two ago. And I guess you didn't get a keynote. You knew the person who got it. You felt very much so like, you know, you were more qualified than they were. And you hit the bike, as I recall, and you hit it hard. And you know what? That video candidly was inspiring to me because I, you know, we've all been there. We've all faced rejection, you know, and you could tell you were passionate about it and you know, you were upset about it, but you used that as fuel after you got on the bike or used it as fuel to get on the bike. And then after you got on the bike, you could tell your mindset had shifted and that was very cool. So speaking of earlier, you mentioned you were most productive on a flight or in flight. Mm-hmm. Share some of that advice. I know you've done that in the past, but with our audience, you know, I'm guessing when life is normal, there's more travel going on. These folks are traveling and they're visiting multiple locations and conferences and trade shows and corporate meetings. How do you stay productive on a flight?
So for me, it's about taking my laptop, taking a good quality pair of headphones, spend the money on a good pair of headphones, and not eating crap. So the food you have on planes is designed, on long flights, it's designed to keep you logy, and it's double the carbs and double the fats. It's because food at altitude doesn't taste as good as food on the ground. So they double the fat, they double the carbs to make you feel full and content and put you to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I tend to not eat food on a plane if I can avoid it. Instead, I will bring some protein with me. I'll bring some beef jerky, some nuts, seeds, things like that. And for me, it's about getting on the plane, not drinking. I don't drink. I very rarely drink anymore anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's drinking water, lots and lots of water, and focusing entirely on that. You know, they have Wi-Fi on planes now, but I fly United, so it doesn't really matter because it's terrible. So I don't really use it. You know, for me, it's about getting on the plane, focusing on opening my laptop. I use a you can use Pages, you can use whatever you want, but open a blank sheet and just start writing. And it doesn't have to be perfect. You know, Hemingway said, write drunk, get it sober. Just write.
Yeah.
Right? Get stuff on the page. Right. And I've written, my record, I think, is 37,000 words on a trip from New York to Tokyo.
And you're reminding me, and I think I've told this story before, but isn't that how you wrote one or more of your books as you booked a flight? What's that?
Well, Zombie Loyalist was written on a plane when I didn't have a reason to be on a plane.
Right. Yeah.
Because I needed to get the book done. But all my books have been written on planes.
Yeah. I love that idea because where else are you going to go, right? You're either going to make conversation with somebody, and if you have the quality headphones, you can avoid that. And if that's your mission on the flight, then you do it. I think the way you told me the story was you flew there, turned in a rough draft, hit the hotel, woke up the next day, and you had revisions from your editor that you worked on the flight back or something like that, right?
No, I wrote chapters 1 through 5 on the flight out from New York to Tokyo, landed in Tokyo, went to the lounge, took a shower, had a cup of coffee, got back on the plane, wrote this, in the same seat, same plane, same seat, and wrote the second half of the book on the flight home. So I landed 37 hours after I left with a book.
That is awesome. That's incredible. So many of my colleagues say that they're writing a book during COVID right now, and that while they can't fly, I think that would be a great way to do it. So good for you.
You're listening to On Top of PR with your host, Jason Mudd. Jason is a trusted advisor to some of America's most admired and fastest growing brands. He is the managing partner at Axia Public Relations, a PR agency that guides news, social, and web strategies for national companies. And now, back to the show.
Peter, you also did, you know, a book about customer service, which I think is, or that's a Zombie Loyalist book. That is probably, you know, one of my favorites of the books that you've written. Talk a little bit about that and about how your kind of career has transitioned from, you know, PR to customers, to a customer service keynote speaker, and how you landed there, and what are some of the takeaways that marketing departments need to be thinking about their involvement in customer service?
The customer experience, again, it's so bad that you don't need to be great. The simple act of a smile can go so far. Yeah. Reach out to your audience, say hello, talk to them when you have nothing to sell them, right? Don't reach out when you're trying to sell. I get a couple hundred emails a day from, you know, corporate entities, and I can count on one hand the number that are actually useful. Mm-hmm. Right, the majority of them are trying to sell me, and it's just such a waste. It's, you know, reach out to me with good quality content, and I'll be a lot happier. And chances are, I'll buy from you when I do have something to buy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that goes right back to what you were saying earlier about media relations and working with journalists. You know, build the relationship first. Don't just come to them and say, you know, with your hand out saying, help me, right? Find out how you can help them. Find out what motivates them. Do a little homework, a little research, a little relationship building techniques.
100%. You know, there's nothing wrong with just talking. You know, talk to your audience will tell you exactly how they like to get their information if you let them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Peter, you mentioned earlier you're still speaking, you're still doing more virtual speaking engagements and things like that. What are some of your current keynote topics?
So I talk about the customer economy. So the next 50 years of the economy are going to be run by the customer experience. I talk about neurodiversity. I talk about customer experience in the travel and tourism sectors as well. So between the three of those, it keeps me pretty busy.
Yeah. And when you're not working, Peter, you keep pretty busy also you love to be fit. You love to skydive you're a big NASA fan. What else do you do?
Lately, it's been with my daughter. So lately, yeah. I've been just having a blast with her. I'm a single dad. So, you know, if I'm not on my Peloton bike or working lately, I've pretty much been jumping. I'm not jumping out of planes. I've pretty much been hanging out with her.
So speaking of, how old do you have to be to skydive?
18 is usually the consensus.
Yeah. And so do you think your daughter will take...
She's already said she wants to. Her mom doesn't necessarily agree with her, but 18, she can pretty much do whatever she wants, I guess.
There you go. That's right. I've got a 17-year-old who keeps reminding me that she'll be 18 soon and she can do whatever she wants. So,
Very true.
Well, I'll tell you, it's on my bucket list to skydive. I've never done it, obviously, but I have an incredible fear of heights. But when I get on something like a roller coaster or otherwise, I love it. I'm thrilled. It's just that first step, right?
Well, nice thing about skydiving is that you're so high that it doesn't really, the fear of heights doesn't really kick in, right? Yeah. It, fear of heights kicks in when you're in the 25th story of a building and you look down, you can make out, okay, that's a car, that's a tree. If I impact that, that's going to hurt. At 13,000 feet, you're like, okay, that's dark down there and it's blue up there. And that's pretty much all you got.
Okay.
So the fear of heights doesn't really enter into it. I think you should try it. You'll be okay.
I want to try it, but my palms are already getting sweaty just thinking about it. So I've got some work to do there, but I can tell you it's one of those things. Once I do it, I think I'll get the itch and love to do it. And plus it's one of those things that just, you know, I believe in the expression, what you fear most is what you most need to do. And so I think if I conquered that, it would be pretty outstanding. So
yep.
Peter, what gives you butterflies and sweaty palms? What are you afraid of?
Good question. I'll never cave dive. That much is for sure. I'll never scuba dive through a cave. I think that's insanity. But I've seen videos of these people squeezing themselves through caves and you know, having to take off their air and carry it. No, thank you. I'm good. But you know, I think that my greatest fear is missing out on an opportunity because I was afraid to take the risk.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I enjoy very much taking as many risks as I can that are calculated risks. That's a big difference. You know,
sure.
I know that if I walked on the roof, I live on the 56th floor, and I know that if I opened my window and crawled outside and held on by my fingertips, that's not a calculated risk. That's stupid, right? The key is understanding where that risk is and taking a calculated risk. When I skydive, I've done my homework. I've done my training. I know what my gear can do. I know how to do it. You know, so that's an entirely different world.
Do you have any interest in and I don't know the terminology, you definitely would, where people jump off of buildings?
Base jumping. Yeah. No, you know, I have really no need. I mean, I enjoy the free fall aspect. I love being in free fall. I love the minute and a half that I'm floating. You know, I don't need to make that 13 seconds to open my parachute. I'm
right. Good. And then what's the other thing?
I tell people that I'm the world's most boring skydiver.
What's the other thing with the suit that they put on that gives you the wings?
Wingsuiting. Yeah, that's fun too. I've never done wingsuiting. I've ridden a wingsuiter. So I got on a wingsuiter's back. We jumped out of the plane together and I sort of rode him halfway down. So that was
right. Fun. Oh, that's cool. So I mentioned bucket list earlier. What's on your bucket list, Peter?
Getting back in the air to travel, I definitely want. I was supposed to be. I mean, there's so many places I was supposed to be this year that I'm very fortunate that towards the end of last year, I was able to go to the Maldives and Abu Dhabi. I was invited to both places, one for Formula One and another for a launch of a major hotel. So that was an incredible experience. But yeah, I've visited about 46 countries, so I have about 100 and something more countries to go.
Wow.
And I'd like, in a perfect world, I'd like to set foot in every country.
A little more local. Have you been to all 50 states?
I have.
Okay. And if you, and I know, by the way, kudos to you. I know each year you give away some airline miles to help people be reunited with their loved ones during the holidays. And that's very cool of you. If you were going on vacation, what's the destination you would want to go to?
I mean, the Maldives was stunning. Yeah. I will go back to Dubai in a heartbeat. You know, I'm looking at potentially purchasing property there.
Okay.
I'm a fan of anywhere where I can find something new and learn. I mean, I've skydived in Dubai. I've skydived in Barcelona. It's you know, I just like having fun.
Is there a place that you would get a keynote invite to that you would drag your feet to have to go to?
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm still looking for that customer experience keynote in North Korea. So we'll see what I can do.
There we go. Awesome. Peter, this has been fun. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for how you give back to the community. You are always soliciting ways that you can give back. And I know for a fact from experience that you make good on those. So thank you for sharing today.
Pleasure was mine. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And if our audience wants to connect with you, how do they find you on the internet?
I'm at Peter Shankman on all the socials. And my email is petershankman.com. I welcome the email. And my website is either shankman.com, shankminds.com is my mastermind group. And then Faster Than Normal is the podcast.
Absolutely. So tune into that podcast and connect with Peter. He's always got something interesting to say. And he doesn't hide it. He tells you exactly how it is and how he feels. And that's always entertaining and amusing. Peter, closing question. Are you working on a new book?
I'm always working on something. I have a couple of ideas in the hopper. Yeah, it's, you know, there's only, like I said, when used to having a 45-minute speech take 4 hours to give, and all of a sudden it takes 45 minutes, you get a lot of extra time in your hands. So, yeah, I'm doing a lot of writing.
Good for you, man. Hey, keep up the good work. Thanks again, and be well, my friend.
All right, take care.
Thanks. Bye.
This has been On Top of PR with Jason Mudd, presented by Review Maxer.